Hello, this is William Fink of Christogenia.org, and this is Christogenia Internet Radio. This program is being pre-recorded for Friday, December 9th, 2022. Right now it is Sunday morning, December 4th, and I have a man here whom I respect very much and met 5 years ago and haven't been able to get him on a podcast until today, just the way things go. And I would like to introduce him to our people because his image, and even though it's a worthy image, is really not a good description of who he is. Everybody knows him as the Vanguard at Charlottesville, and he is actually much more than that. It's the image that came out of all of that media back 5 years ago that can't be, well, it is what it is, and I thought the optics were wonderful, but nobody knows who Michael Tubbs really is, so we have him here with us this evening. Michael Tubbs is the chief of the staff of the League of the South, and he is the chairman of the Florida State chapter of the League of the South. It's been my good pleasure to work with him these past 5 years. Sir, thank you for joining us today.
Bill, thank you very much for having me here. It is a great honor to be here speaking to you and your listeners. I have to apologize. I know you've tried to get me on one of your podcasts for years, but ever since I joined the league, I've tried to be somewhat of the gray man. Of course, the SPLC wouldn't allow me to do that for very, very long, but I've never liked talking about myself, and I hate hearing my own voice being recorded. But a few other people have talked me into doing podcasts with them, and I thought it was a long past time to do one with you, sir.
Well, thank you, sir. I appreciate it. It's probably since Charlottesville that I've wanted you on a podcast, but that's
Yeah.
fine. It's all in Yahweh's good timing. It's all in God's good timing, and
Yes.
that's the way it is. I think it's beneficial that our people get to know you, and well, I think that they'll find the real Michael Tubbs is a lot deeper than the images at Charlottesville. So the League of the South, what I'm trying to say is the League of the South has a lot more substance than simply the optics that came out of Charlottesville. What which are I mean, I thought the optics were wonderful, but that's you can't judge by appearances. That's the way it is. You can't make a rational judgment from only seeing those images. The
Yeah, sir.
cause of Southern nationalism, it is a viable cause, and it's a necessary cause. I mean, this government, this federal government is an evil entity. It's been an evil entity for 100 years, and it's definitely not the nation that originated 250 years ago. Not even close.
Well, I have to agree that there is a lot more substance to the League of the South than pretty much any other organization that I've investigated. That was one of the reasons that I joined. And also, as you say, this is an evil empire. And once I came to understand how evil it was, I naturally wandered towards the League of the South after much investigation on my part of other organizations. So the League is of the South is full of men with substance, and I'm happy to be counted among them. And I think it's the only tool available that can eventually defeat this evil empire.
You've been a member of the League of the South for at least 25 years. And I don't remember exactly when you joined. I know it was very shortly after the League was formed. perhaps you can speak about those early years. I also know that you're an identity Christian also, and Christian people always like to hear how that happened. You don't have to go into all the details, but it would be interesting for people to hear.
Sure. Well, as far as my membership in the League of the South, it goes back to the year 2000. The league was formed in 1994. The Florida League was formed in 1996. And I didn't find out about it until the year 2000. I got here as fast as I could. It all started when, before I even had access to the internet, my brother had internet at his house, and he brought me over to show me something on the computer, and it was an announcement about something called a Declaration of Southern Cultural Independence, I think it was, and it was going to be held in Montgomery, Alabama, on March 4th of 2000, which just happens to coincide with Confederate Flag Day. So my wife and I thought this was very interesting. We didn't know anything about the League of the South, very little about Southern nationalism. So we went to Montgomery to check this out, and we were absolutely dumbfounded by the amount of participation and the speakers there. We went to the state capitol in Montgomery and stood near the bottom of the stairs, and we watched literally thousands of people marching down the street, coming around a corner, and the formation of people just never seemed to stop. The streets were filled with people with the South in their hearts, and it was just awe-inspiring. And then we got to listen to the speeches of several folks, and including Dr. Hill himself. It was the first time I'd ever laid eyes on Dr. Hill, ever heard him speak. And between him and the other speakers, I realized that this was the real deal. This was going to be my future. This was going to be my home. And I really wanted to know everything I could about the League of the South. And it just so happened that I saw somebody in the crowd that was wearing, excuse me, was waving a 1861 Florida flag, which nobody, hardly anybody knows what that flag is. And when I saw it, I said, well, this guy knows what time it is. So I went over and talked to him, and come to find out, he lived like 20 miles down the road from me. And he said, well, we need to get together and have some meetings and get something started in our area. And the closest league chapter to me, because I lived in Jacksonville, Florida, the closest league chapter to me was up in Brunswick, Georgia, like maybe 45, 50 minutes away. So he and I drove up there to these meetings and participated in the Southeast Georgia chapter. And man, I was hooked. I really loved it. And we participated in the Georgia League of the South before we could form our own chapter in Northeast Florida. And once we did, things just took off, and it's been great ever since.
Well, that's wonderful. I mean, your wife was on board with you, so to speak, so that's an ideal situation because as far as I know, she never what was a hindrance to you in your league activities. I know that for certain.
No, never once was she ever a hindrance to my league activities. She was a hardcore Southern patriot. She was from the mountains of North Carolina, a pure-hearted Southern girl. And in fact, I told people before, our marriage was so great that the only thing that we ever had any kind of argument over was who was more Southern than the other. And it really wasn't an argument on my part. I was just kind of teasing her along, but she was very adamant about her being more Southern than I was for some reason. But yeah, she was a great blessing to me in the League of the South. She had an officer position in our Northeast Florida chapter for a long while. he did some outstanding work for the League of the South, building websites and things like that.
Well, I'm sure that she's very dearly missed, sir. Your introduction to Christian identity, is that also from your brother? I'm just curious. People like to hear these stories, how somebody becomes awakened. I mean, we always look for ways to get people to think about our positions and realize that our positions are the closest that we could get today. Mm-hmm. I mean, I pray to godly biblical positions and a godly biblical outlook on life. That's what attracted me to the League of the South, was those position papers. Especially the position papers on kith and kin and theocracy that were written by Michael Hill, I believe. So those papers, when I read them, I realized that the objectives and principles of the League of the South were indeed my own objectives and principles.
Right. Well, as far as how I came across Christian identity, no, it was actually the other way around. I introduced my brother to it, but this was in the days before the internet. This was in the late 1980s. And when I was in the military, I was stationed at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, and I used to frequent a used bookstore there called Edward McKay's Used Books. And it just recently closed down a few years back, but it was such a gold mine of wonderful books. I could stay there for hours looking around. It was a small bookstore, but it had such a fascinating collection of books. And one day I was in there. I was mostly focused on political books, military history, things like that. But I found this one book. Yahweh led my fingers to it, and in the way that Yahweh usually does. he showed me a book that I wasn't even looking for. And it was called The United States and Britain in Prophecy, and I'm sure all of your listeners are quite familiar with it. As I understand things today, I guess it's more of a British Israelism type of book, more so than hardcore Christian identity. Would you call it that?
Yes, I would, but they weren't wrong about everything. I mean, they were right about a lot of things. So
right.
It's just an important step in our awakening.
Yeah, well, that was my first step, and I was immediately fascinated with it, and it really, really brought me back to the Bible to confirm or deny the things that were in this book. But the most important part of stumbling across, I can't say stumbling because Yahweh handed it to me, but the most important part of being handed this book was there was a card within the pages, and it was a card advertising a Bible study. And I don't know if any of your listeners would be familiar with it or not, but it was called, it was from an organization called the Christian Committee to Teach Bible Law out of Lake Moore, Ohio. And the card offered two free Bible studies if you just mail it in. And I thought, well, whoever put it in this book must have thought that the teachings in this Bible study were relevant to this book. And I was really enjoying what I was reading in the book. So I went ahead and I mailed off for them. And the study originally, the first few parts of the Bible study focus on Bible law. Well, the entire course was on Bible law. But as you got deeper into it, it showed the person taking the Bible study why the law was important because of who they were. And it eventually got on to the Christian identity message. And I was just floored by all this. All of a sudden, the lights went on. Everything started to make sense. Every subject under the sun made sense now. Everything was tied together in life. And it didn't matter if it was religion, politics, race, economics. Suddenly, God's law brought everything together for me, and it was clear for the first time in my life. And the good thing about this Bible study was that it introduced you to other aspects of Christian identity, other preachers. I got to meet other identity ministers like Pastor Pete Peters and Colonel Jack Moore and probably 10 others. Start ordering their materials because of the addresses provided in this Bible study. And it was no time at all before I was fully immersed in Christian identity. And in the early stages of taking this Bible course, I contacted my brother to tell him about this new revelation, you know, and he was immediately excited. He liked everything that he heard, and I gave him the address to it, and he started taking it himself, and both of us together, we were deeply involved in it, and he was strongly CI like I was. So that's basically the beginning of my Christian identity transformation. Yahweh threw it in my face because it was time for me to hear the message, and I took to it like a duck on water. And I've never looked back. I've never doubted it, and it's been the Christian identity message has been an incredible blessing throughout my entire life. And because I believe that the knowledge of Yahweh and Yahshua and the true message, because I know these things, I think I've been blessed because of it. Once I started praying in the names of Yahweh and Yahshua, it's like more of my prayers were answered in the affirmative rather than the negative. And it's just been an incredible journey for me. And I praise Yahweh for giving me that one opportunity so many years ago to hear his word properly.
That's actually incredible to hear, because we had never spoke about this before, even though I'd probably seen you 100 times. We've never really spoke about many of these things. So it's incredible to hear, because it's nothing like I expected to hear. So that's really interesting that you found this on your own and took the initiative to pursue it. And that's a very rare occurrence, actually.
I wasn't aware of that, but we haven't discussed this before, because like I said earlier, I very seldom ever talk about myself. I'm always interested in the people around me, and I've always found that it was wiser to shut up and listen than to open one's mouth. And I never thought I had anything interesting to say. And some people probably still don't think I do, but I haven't told very many people that story. I mean, this is going to be the first time that my story has been heard, and that, you know, on that subject far and wide. I might have told a couple other people in the past, but that story, the events surrounding that story, was one of the greatest blessings of my life, and changed me forever.
Well, there are people that have found Christian identity on their own on the internet. Today is a different world, but to find it in a bookstore and decide to test it for yourself, that's to me, that's just, I mean, that's what basically I had done, but even I had been introduced to the subject by someone else, who gave me a pile of books to read and said, "Bill, why don't you read these?" So it's a totally different experience, I believe, to find it in a bookstore for your own and choose to read the book and then actually pursue it. That's today, people stumble across it on the internet, and I think maybe 3/4 of the responses I get, and you know that probably like 0.1% of the people actually respond. 3/4 of those responses are negative, right? They want to argue with me right away before they even read.
Right.
that's the typical response. So it's a really cool story that the way you came into Christian identity is, I believe it's doesn't happen or didn't happen very often, I don't think.
Well, you know, I never really thought about it that way until you just said that. It just seemed like the most natural thing for me when I read that book and ordered that Bible study. But you know, Christ's sheep hear his voice and follow him. And he raised his voice to me. Perhaps it hadn't been loud enough in years past. You know, I've been a Christian all my life. I was born into the Catholic faith, basically. I know some people don't consider that Christian, but, you know, I knew who God was. I knew who Christ was in an infant kind of way. I went to a parochial school from kindergarten through high school. Went to church every Wednesday, and my mom took me every Sunday. I didn't like public speaking, but at that time, for my age, I guess somebody thought that I was a better public speaker than most, and they coaxed me into getting up on the pulpit and doing readings from the Bible during the Mass, and I hated that more than anything, getting up in front of people and talking. But I've been a Christian all my life, but it wasn't until I found that book that I thought that I was really on the right path. I had a lot of doubts in my life about Catholicism, and I started dabbling in Protestantism. And it didn't seem like they had the answers. There was a lot of, when I was in Catholic school, I don't remember us ever studying the Bible, which seems kind of strange looking back on it. They told us what was in the Bible, and they might have cracked the Bible a few times and had us read some passages, but we never studied the Bible. And it wasn't until I was introduced to Christian identity that I became a scholar of the Bible, actually studying it rather than reading it. And I think that's one thing that separates most Christian identity folks from the rest of the religious denominations is, every Christian identity person I've ever run across, they know the Bible forward and backward. They know things that the average Catholic or Protestant or probably Orthodox don't even know. And, one argument I've heard people make about Christian identity is that it's counter to Catholicism or Protestantism. And I don't think it's counter to any of them. I think it augments them. I think it gives them a better understanding of the Bible. What are your thoughts on that? Don't you think that you could possibly be a Catholic or a standard Protestant and still believe in the tenets of Christian identity? What do you think about that?
That's okay. That's a hard line to walk. I was raised a Catholic also, and even though only one of my grandparents was raised a Catholic, I was raised a Catholic. So the others were Lutheran and Baptist. So I know that the Catholic Church is rife with idolatry and pagan practices and beliefs that were folded into the church in the 3rd and 4th centuries AD. So you could be a Christian identity believer and attend perhaps a vanilla white church out in the middle of the rural Tennessee, and maybe your church isn't Christian identity, but you are, and you can cope in that church because all of the people are your ethnic kindred, and that's fine, but how many of us had that opportunity?
Not very many.
So it's really hard to me for a Christian identity believer to balance both worlds, unless you're in that sort of situation, because you want to care. If you're in a local white community and you can attend a white church, we have a natural empathy and a natural need to have communion with our own people. So if that's your only opportunity, yeah, that's fine. But to me, it's your church. It is your kindred community, and it's not some building somewhere. I think that League of the South members, the League of the South, our local chapter should be our church. And they're the people that once a week and have communion with once a week.
Yeah. One thing that Christian Identity has done for me is it's certainly helped me become a fruit inspector of churches. And, you know, people ask me, you know, you seem to be a hardcore Christian and you seem to be very religious. Why don't you go to church? And my answer is, Christ's sheep go where they are fed. And honestly, none of these churches that are around me are going to feed me. You know, if anything, I'd be feeding them. I'm not trying to be, self-righteous in that regard. It's just that, and again, I know it sounds horrible, but I just know more than they do. Okay.
Well, right.
Going to those churches would be useless to me. And like you said about your local chapter, the League is my church. The League is where my fellow kindred are, and they understand. And surprisingly, as you can attest, there is an unusually large number of Christian Identity adherents within the League of the South. I'm not sure how that works out, except God puts all of his people in one place for a reason. And so the League is my church, and it has been for a long time. That's where I go to learn.
If you read our position papers, and a lot of our detractors don't read those papers. I know they don't read those papers. If you read our position papers, that they're all about kith and kin, that the common blood ties of true Southerners, and the putting of God and his law as the placement of that as the foremost authority and law of the land.
You're talking about how you're talking about the kinship of League members in particular and Southerners in general. It reminds me of a story I wanted to tell you. I told you, of course, that my wife was a very active member of the League of the South before she got real sick. And she was very much into her genealogy. She actually traced several lines back to Adam. And I know there's people that won't believe that, but the kings and queens of Europe were very much into their genealogy, and just every one of them can trace their lines back to Adam. And if you're into genealogy and you find a tie to a royal family, then you know that you're an Adamite. But, she was a member of our local chapter for many years and was working on her genealogy. And she came to find out that two people in our local chapter were kindred of hers going back maybe six or seven generations, if that. And here we were, attending meetings every week and didn't even know that she was related to these people. And it was quite the eye opener. And it's just another one of those times when you realize that Southerners are just one big extended family. And that really put the spotlight on the League's promotion of the League as a family. And, all Southerners are family members. I don't care who you are, really.
Well, it's only common sense that if you're from old blood, meaning the original colonial blood in Georgia, that you're going to have descendants from those original Scottish colonizers of Georgia, that the original settlers of Georgia. And yes, we probably all are all related in many ways down the road. Yeah. I mean, okay, I worked with Clifton Emmaheiser for years. And when Clifton in, I think it was 2017, showed me his paternal genealogy, his paternal ancestors came from a village perhaps 20 miles from the where my paternal ancestors came from, in Germany.
Wow. Yeah. That's amazing.
All white people are much more closely related if we're from any particular region of Europe, and even not necessarily the same region in Europe, we're much more closely related than we think. And every white man is probably your cousin in one way or another. So
right. Yeah, before the days of the interstate highway system and aircraft transportation, we were obviously much tighter knit communities. One of my aunts and uncles, in my genealogy research, I discovered that they were fourth cousins. And you know, obviously there's nothing wrong with that, obviously, as some people would suggest, but I just found it fascinating, the many links in the family trees going back together to each other. You know, 5, 6, 7, 8 generations removed from each other. And is genealogy is such an amazing hobby and tool. It was fascinating.
The league is often criticized for originally being a CivNat, a civic nationalist organization. And it's definitely, I believe it's shifted to where it is today, but every organization matures and develops and strengthens its principles if it's a legitimate organization, in my opinion. I don't know if you can lend more insight to that, what your feelings are on that.
Yeah, I think I can. I've had a lot of very long talks with Dr. Hill over the years, and I've come to the understanding that Dr. Hill had a vision for the future, which is almost where we are now. But the problem Dr. Hill had was that others did not share that vision properly. You know, Dr. Hill has always been pro-secession and, you know, pro-Southern nationalist. He's not been a civic nationalist, but the people that surround him, some of them needed a better education. And I'm not saying that they were dummies or anything. He had some of the absolute brightest minds of the South around him, but they were still wed to some aspects of civic nationalism, probably out of fear, probably out of you know, just ease of getting along with their neighbors. But Dr. Hill has always been a Southern nationalist. When I first joined the league, like I said, the league was formed in, I think, 92, and I didn't come around until 2000. But when I came around, there were a lot of people who were primarily members of the Sons of Confederate Veterans. And after joining the Sons of Confederate Veterans, I found out that the one group of people in the United States who ought to be pro-secession were not pro-secession. They were not Southern nationalists. They were American nationalism, or American nationalists living in the South. And I guess their influx into the league was due to the fact that the Sons of Confederate Veterans, or the SCV, was just not hardcore enough for them. So when they heard about the formation of the League of the South, a lot of them came over, And it kind of spoiled things for Dr. Hill's vision, in my opinion. Dr. Hill might have a different opinion than me on this, but it seemed to me like they were trying to run the League of the South like it was an annex of the SCV. They brought over a lot of their baggage with them and some of their foolish thinking. Most of the SCV, in my opinion, they wanted to wave the Confederate battle flag and honor their ancestors, but make sure that everybody around them knew that they weren't racist. Don't get me wrong. There are some fantastic men in the Sons of Confederate Veterans. I've met them. I've known them. They were some of my greatest allies during my most trying times when the SPLC was writing articles about me. They stood up for me and agreed with me and my positions 100%. But the vast majority are a bunch of grannies, as we called them. And a lot of them came over to the League of the South and kind of grannified the League. But I think that started to change when Dr. Hill wrote that article titled Kith and Kin or a Proposition Nation. In fact, I remember sitting in a bar with Dr. Hill around a big table full of people, and he was talking about this article. And I said, you know, sir, this is going to cause a lot of people to get upset with you and the League and leave. And he said, so be it. So that was a big line in the sand for a bunch of people. When you start talking about your own kith and kin first and foremost above everybody else, it shouldn't be, but that's the way it was. So I think that document was made a big change in the League, and it helped to get rid of some of the grannies, some of the people who were there for the wrong reasons, people who did not believe in secession. They were just Americans waving a Confederate flag. I think the document was a big help, and things have only gotten better from there with the League of the South. There's no more talk about, you know, America first or Americanism or any of that buffoonery that we used to hear. And it's, I think it's more in line with what Dr. Hill originally envisioned. I'm not trying to speak for Dr. Hill, but I think that's where he wanted to go with it.
Well, some people deride me for using the term patriotard. I have some clown and bitchute comments that follows, not me, but follows people who work with me around, and they deride me because I use the word patriotard. They slander me as a Jew. I'm a Jew because I call people patriotards. So, I mean, among a whole long list of other laundry items. So, if you read your New Testament, Christ only commanded two things of his disciples: to keep the commandments and to love one another. And that one another are the people whom he came for, the house of Judah, the house of Israel, the scattered 12 tribes. If you have no sense of your own ethnic identity, then you have no future. And I don't know, to worship this flag and this government is basically why I call these people patriotards. They put this flag and this government foremost in their lives and worship it, my government right or wrong, and bumper stickers like that I saw from the time I was a child in the 1960s. And at a very early point in my life, I realized that that was wrong, and I had never even read a Bible.
Well, you know as well as I do that the word patriot is not being used properly by these people.
Right.
You know the origin, the Latin origins of the word, where it stems from, what it really means. And these people have it all reversed. So patriotard is an excellent description of these people who have put government and magic dirt first before their own flesh and blood kinsmen. I think patriotard is completely appropriate.
Absolutely. And I'm not going to cease from using it. It describes these people that worship the government rather than God. Yeah. That's how I use the term. So that it sort of bothers me that anybody that claims to be an identity Christian, not only a League of the South member, that these aren't League of the South members doing this, but anybody who claims to be an identity Christian or anything similar to that, a white nationalist, would be offended by the word patriotard. It's amazing to me.
Yeah, I have known some Christian identity folks in the past. They were absolutely few and far between, but some of them might have been considered patriotards. You know, they think that the entire United States, you know, the U.S. Constitution is like the last book of the Bible right after Revelations. you know, the United States as a whole, including every single member of it, is probably the New Jerusalem or something. I think there's some of that in Christian identity circles. I'm not one of them, but I know what you mean.
That there is too much of that in Christian identity circles. It's and that's also tied to the term that you used a few minutes ago, magic dirt.
Yeah.
It's the ground itself isn't holy. It doesn't make you holy. It doesn't give you any special privileges. The problem with people today is that they believe their rights and privileges come from the government that's in control of that ground.
Right.
It's their attitudes are all backwards, as you stated. That they're. It's incredible that the position papers, you know, the kith and kin or a proposition nation and the League and Theocracy were probably, I mean, the other position papers are fine, the Southern Nation and the Great Divide, and I understand that. But those two papers were probably what enticed me to take a better look at the League of the South above all the others. Because those should be the foremost importance to an identity Christian. And those two papers showed me that the League was compatible with my own beliefs. I had a lot of opportunities to join a lot of organizations from when I started doing this in 2008. And I passed up all those opportunities. I passed up the NSN movement because I didn't trust Jeff Shoup. Or Scope, or however he pronounces his name. I never trusted him.
And why as you were in light of current events.
well, right, exactly. So anyway, doing what I do, and Christy Gettinger, of course, is all that I do, if I don't do something in the real world, I'm useless. And I'm just a keyboard warrior or a keyboard coward. I have to get out and do something in the real world. And I didn't find a Christigenia is not a movement, right? It's not that type of organization. It's not even really an organization. It's just me. So I wouldn't expect it to ever be a movement. And I'm not ever trying to be a leader in that capacity. I'm just a Bible teacher, basically. So I have to do something in the real world. I need a vehicle through which to do that. And to me, the League of the South was the perfect expression. And people, another question that people often raise is, why the South? Why are you concentrating on the South? And this is an issue that's even been divisive within the League. And the bottom line is that the South is where I live. It's where I was born, even though people wouldn't believe that. It's where I live. And I could feel and see and touch my Florida, right? I mean, yeah. I can't help people in New York hands-on. So why should I be concerned about people in New York? Even if they're white nationalists, I can't help them. I have to concentrate on my own local community. That's all that we as human men can really do. We're not gods.
I agree. I see so many people. We just had a little blow up here recently. Somebody who was a League of the South member attended several national conferences, attended several league demonstrations, but they live north of the Mason-Dixon line, and they're upset because the League of the South leaves their precious dirt out of the equation. Well, you know, we've already talked about how Southerners are just one big extended family. And, you know, the South is a real place, and the Southern people are a separate and distinct nation on this continent. Our Confederate ancestors knew this back then, that there were at least two separate nations on this continent from the very beginning. And, you know, the sources of migration prove this out, and the differences between where most Southerners came from and where most Northerners came from. We were fighting each other back in the old country before this continent was even discovered. And then once it was discovered, those two warring factions just came over here and continued their war on the new soil. We're a different people from our neighbors to the north and west, and we always will be. There can never be any real reconciliation between us just because they have white skin. I'm sorry to say that doesn't make them necessarily 100% our near kinsmen, just as much as anybody who's a member of any white-skinned Antifa or white-skinned BLM supporter or white-skinned foaming mouth communist. Those are not my brothers. And obviously our Yankee brethren are not that bad, but a lot of them just don't like us. They're a separate people from us, just like we're a separate people from them. And they need to do what they can do in their own homeland up there above the Mason-Dixon line to free themselves from the wicked government that we are under and put their own house in order. We could live peacefully as neighbors under separate governments if they would just put their minds and actions to it. They don't need to live with us. They can live beside us, just like good neighbors.
Well, that's absolutely true, and that's the way it should be. That the most Americans don't understand the struggles in England before the Puritans had left and settled in Massachusetts. But those Puritans are the intellectual brain children of men like Oliver Cromwell, who sought to enforce their view of the Bible and to force that on everybody else.
And that's exactly what we've been getting ever since Mayflower folks got lost on their way to Jamestown and ended up in present-day Massachusetts. And they preached that they are the ones who founded America, and all of our history springs from them, and they know better in everything, and we best listen to them.
Right. And none of that is true, but that is their attitude. That is a lot of modern Americans consider that to be a Northeast liberal attitude, but it's not. It's a Puritan attitude, in my opinion. And if we studied the religious cults of the North and who the abolitionists were, and we would have a much better understanding of the War of Northern Aggression and the subsequent struggles in this country.
Absolutely. Those two different peoples with two different mindsets about the way things should be done. And the Northern strain has always sought to dominate the Southern strain, and it has caused nothing but friction between our peoples since the founding of this country.
Right. But even the North is divided, and they only came together on that one issue in the 1850s, probably, the Quakers and the Puritans and other sects in the North. They only agreed on that, in my opinion. They don't agree on a lot of other things.
Well, it's much the same in the South. You know, we disagree on a lot of things down here in the South, but a lot of us know who we are and that we're all brothers and sisters down here. I hate quoting pagans, but in my extensive travels overseas and in the Middle East, I heard a lot of people of the Middle Eastern persuasion. They had a saying that what was it? It was me and my brother against my cousin, me and my cousin against the world. And, you know, basically it's a level of kinship based on blood. You know, you might be fighting with your cousin today, but when some outsider comes in and wants to bother your cousin, then you and your cousin are going to join forces to fight the outsider. And that's the way Southerners are. You know, we're a martial race of people. In fact, we provide the highest percentage of soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines to the federal empire's forces. And when we're not fighting with a foreign enemy, we're fighting amongst ourselves just to stay in prime condition, you know?
well, right. But, and I agree with that, but I see the sects in the South as completely different. I mean, you have your Church of Christ people, your Baptist, your Methodist, but I don't see them trying to really force each other into one another's churches by violence.
Right, right.
Or imposing their values on other kindred Southerners by violence. I don't see that. I don't think there has ever been an example of that.
I don't ever recollect anything in history that would show Southerners doing that to each other.
Charlottesville. This conversation should have to turn to Charlottesville sooner or later. And I would just like to I don't want to lead your reflections on Charlottesville. I don't want to entice you to say anything, but being, Charlottesville was just weeks before I actually sent my check-in to join the League of the South. But I considered myself as being a member of the League of the South at Charlottesville, even though I wasn't officially. Let me say that. So we didn't expect any violence at Charlottesville like we met with. And in my opinion, the shields and the helmets and things like that were only in response to things that happened earlier that year in Pikeville and other places. So if we'd have expected any violence, I certainly would have never had my wife with me. And we had a lot of women right. with us and older people that could barely walk, never mind people that could fight.
Yeah.
Charlottesville has been seriously mischaracterized by the popular mainstream press.
I agree. You know, our demonstration at Pikeville, the police established barricades for both the opposing sides. Everybody stayed on their sides of the barricades. There was a lot of shouting and carrying on, but there was no physical violence, as I recall, between the two opposing sides. But it gave us a good look at Antifa, I think, maybe for the first time. And we had seen Antifa in operation on television for quite some time, and the brutality that they were capable of against demonstrators or counter-demonstrators. And I think when we went to Pikeville, we kind of expected maybe something like that would occur. But thankfully, the police did their job, established the barricades, and kept everybody apart. But by the time it came for Charlottesville, you know, we were going to err on the side of caution. And we only had 12 shields, and, you know, there was over 1,000 of our people there. The League of the South had made 12 shields. And, you know, we had got rumors through the grapevine that Antifa and other communist organizations were planning violence. We didn't know how that violence could be carried out, you know, based on the model of Pikeville. We thought the police are going to do their job. They're going to keep everybody separated. Yeah, there might be some shelling, shouting and yelling, but, you know, probably weren't going to be actually in physical contact with anyone. But you never know, so some folks prepared for the worst, and the planning was purely defensive in nature. You know, the shields are defensive tools, helmets are defensive tools, and we had no plan set in motion to do anything other than protect ourselves. In fact, we established some guidelines the night before, basically rules of engagement. And, you know, we even told our people how they were supposed to wave at folks so as not to confuse our wave with a Roman salute. That's the kind of situation we expected. You know, we might be interacting with people, you know, in a peaceful way, and we didn't want to, you know, throw up the Roman salute or anything. But our rules of engagement basically said that, you know, you will not initiate violence. You will only respond in measured violence to violence to yourself. You can defend yourself and the person next to you, but you're not to initiate any violence on your own. And everybody from the League of the South understood that going in there. In fact, in the meeting the night before at our campground, a number of other organizations were present, and they understood that as well. And I think it wasn't a big surprise to anybody, because in our planning, we understood that before we got to the outskirts of Charlottesville, that we were there to defend a Confederate monument, to get some name recognition for our organizations, and just basically peacefully protest. And when we got there, we realized that that wasn't going to work at all. As soon as we come up that hill towards the park and the streets were blocked by communists, angry communists, I will add, we knew that things were not going to go to plan. We know that no plan ever survives first contact with the enemy, but we didn't know how bad it was going to be. And they were there. I can tell you from the signs that they carried and the viciousness that they dealt out, that they would not have been bothered a bit if any of us had been killed. So we defended ourselves as best we could and had to fight our way into that park just so we could have a peaceful place to stand that wasn't being pelted by bags of urine and feces and acid and, you know, chunks of concrete and such. We've had to run a gauntlet to get inside that park, and people were pepper spraying us and beating us with sticks all the way in there. It's like you said, we had a lot of elderly folks with us, had women. Thankfully, I don't recall seeing any children along with us, but we never would have brought our elderly and our women there if we had come there for a fight. So most of our time was spent on the way in, and while we were there, shielding our elderly, our women, and our leadership from the attacks of the various communist groups. And one place in particular became hotly contested, and that was the stairs, one of the stairways into the park. And communists focused a lot of their aggressive attention on those of us who were standing on those stairs, blocking them from coming in and doing damage to our women, our elderly, and giving our leadership some breathing room because they were supposed to speak that day. And we didn't want them having to be concerned about Antifa rushing in and, you know, trashing the podium, beating up our speakers and our leadership. So we stood on those stairs and blocked that entrance, and it became known as the Bloody Stair. And those stairs were stained with the blood from many of our people. And I get a little choked up thinking about it.
Right. But, I understand
you
that.
Know, you, know my military, you know my military history, and you know I've been around the world and I've done some things. I've seen some pretty exciting things in my life. But that was one of the proudest moments of my life, standing there on those stairs with those men.
And, well, right, because we're standing for our own principles.
I'm sorry.
It was an opportunity to stand for our own principles rather than the principles of some government that don't necessarily agree with us.
Absolutely. You know, I've been trained to fight communism for over a decade and under somebody else's guidance. But it wasn't until that day in Charlottesville that I actually got to fight real communists. And that was something I'd been waiting for my entire life. And there it was on our own streets. and they were vicious, they were brutal, and they are worthy of our hatred, let me tell you.
And they are, and they are communists, and even most nationalist Americans don't really understand the degree to which they've been indoctrinated with communist ideology. That we hear a lot about critical race theory today, and most people don't understand that critical race theory is only a derivative of critical theory from the Frankfurt School. And critical race theory was formulated by one of the members of the Frankfurt School, the original Frankfurt School, named Herbert Marcuse, and they wanted to inspire a communist revolution in America, and they failed repeatedly to pit labor against capital in any really divisive or incendiary manner. So after failing repeatedly, they started focusing on the differences between the races in America instead. And every white liberal who has attended a university has been imbued with at least some of Herbert Marcuse's ideas. But the most dangerous of his teachings, I believe, it is that they actually teach that they have the only moral authority in their hands, that the left is the only moral authority. And because all who protest against the left or who disagree with the left have no moral authority and are basically immoral. And they really believe that. And they're taught that in these universities and in very subtle ways. And this has been disseminated throughout our society, and it's a complete backdoor to communism. It's that we don't even see.
Most Americans have, most Americans have no idea the influence that communism has had on changing our country since the founding of the Communist Party USA in 1919, which immediately resulted in what we call the Red Summer, or the first Red Scare. There were bombings and attempted assassinations across the United States carried out by anarcho-communists. And, we had a backdoor love affair with the Soviet Union in the 1930s, and then culminating in the 1940s when, we were basically joined with the communists to help defeat the only forced on the planet that could have wiped out communism right then and there. But most Americans don't realize that the communist government in Moscow had instructed Communist Party USA to work towards a nationwide revolution, and Communist Party USA told them this isn't going to work. These people are too united. So they switched to backing a race war, basically, is what it amounted to. They used the blacks as a tool of communism to promote the revolution in the United States.
Yes.
And the whole civil rights movement was nothing more than one part of the communist revolution. And yes, it was very successful in many fields. A lot of people don't even know about the communists actually supported a radio station on an island off of Cuba that broadcasted revolutionary content to the American Southeast, teaching blacks how to organize and how to fight back, so to speak, how to overthrow their white oppressors. The radio station, surprisingly, was called Radio Free Dixie, and it was run by an American black who had fled North Carolina under charges of having kidnapped two white people. And he made it to Cuba, and he was welcomed there with open arms, given a radio station, and broadcast for quite a while into the American South, trying to stir up black revolutionary spirit. Walter Williams, I think, was his name. I got a whole thing I wrote about it, but it's been a while since I've looked into it. But, that was all part of the anti-Southern Black Revolution of the time period. And it hasn't quit. The communists never quit their revolution. Once the communists win a revolution, the revolution continues to reinforce and stabilize and protect the winnings of the revolution. So communist revolutions never end. They always continue in another form.
And all of that's absolutely true. And I didn't really know about Walter Williams, so that's pretty interesting. I never heard that story, I don't think, in the past.
It's surprising what we don't hear, even in recent history.
Right. Absolutely. I agree that we don't hear anything that doesn't help the communist revolution. We don't hear about it in the media unless it helps the communist revolution, unless it helps them advance their agenda. And I don't know when most quote-unquote normies are going to ever realize that everything that they love and value is at stake, because they just keep making concessions and concessions and concessions and think that they don't believe anything unless it comes from television, and they think that everything is normal. Even the new normal is normal. It's incredible. It's incredibly disappointing. But that's the state we're in for our sin, and this is our punishment. That doesn't mean we as Christians that we should stand by and watch it. We have to be proactive in our communities in resisting it. Its succession has in the eyes of God in the Bible, succession is the only succession from an evil government is an obligation. And it's the only option we have is to resist that evil as Christians, in my opinion. Right. It's not only...
We have too many Christians. I'm sorry.
I just want to say it's not merely a hobby.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
It's not merely a hobby. It's our obligation as Christians.
Absolutely. You're talking about our punishment. You know, obviously, all the punishments from Deuteronomy 28 are upon our disobedient nation. All anybody has to do is go through Deuteronomy 28, look at the curses that are listed there, and they can find every one of them on us right now.
Yes, sir.
But Yahweh punishes us in such a way that we can see where we need to be corrected. And you know, all these punishments point us in the direction that we have failed and we need to make corrections on. But you know, when you're not taught the law in your church, you said you've been told the law has been done away with, you're completely lost. You don't know why. You don't know what the cause and the effect is. You don't understand that you're being subject to divine punishment. And we've got a bunch of people that are in their air-conditioned foxholes trying to pray their way out of all this when God has given us the tools that we need and has done everything but place them in our hands to make corrections to what we have already ruined. Our people need to quit thinking that they're just passing through here, and they need to start working to establish God's kingdom on earth as it is in heaven. It's a sad state of affairs that the churches that we have today, how, you know, they were one of the first, the seminaries and the churches were one of the first institutions that the Communist Party infiltrated and destroyed and have made of no effect for our people. Most of our churches are absolutely worthless as far as making the necessary corrections to our society. The evidence is all around us. We probably have more churches per capita in the South these days, but you know, just look at what's around us. You know, the interracial crime, the miscegenation, the drug use, the single mothers, worthless fathers. It's just terrible, and our churches are not correcting that. At one time in the South, we were a godly nation here, and our churches were the bedrocks of our community. Everything focused around the church and church attendance. And ever since the communists infiltrated and destroyed our seminaries and churches, we've really, really gone downhill, and people act like they don't know why.
Even in our own lifetime, the Supreme Court forced the South to accept interracial marriage, and that happened in 1967.
Right.
And before 1967, the state of Virginia, where I was born, had racial purity laws where you couldn't, that you could not marry someone of a mixed race.
Right. I know that for a fact there were some churches up until the 1980s in the South that refused to perform interracial marriages, but you know that was on the sly, and you know not much attention was given to it. Just sorry, we can't perform that marriage. You know, our apologies. But I think even that, you know, in the last 20 to 30 years, that's, you'd be hard pressed to find a church that would refuse to do that.
I think it was until 1980 that practically every southern state had laws against sodomy, which is today called homosexual relations, right? They had laws against that.
Right.
And I forget the name of the Supreme Court decision, but it was also due to a Supreme Court decision, a federal decision, that those states had to stop enforcing and repeal those laws. That was forced on the South.
Right.
I believe it was 1980,
well,
but I can't remember the name of the decision.
As late as 1948, the Florida Supreme Court said that the death penalty for homosexual behavior was constitutional and justified. That was 1948, and that's not that long ago in the overall scheme of things.
Right. And the point I'm going to make is this, that for 200 years, the South had those laws on their books, and they enforced those laws. You couldn't have mixed-race marriages. You couldn't be a homosexual, at least in public. You would be stoned. You would be executed. You would be put in jail for years if you tried to do those things. And it must have been the churches that approved of those laws, or those laws would have never gotten onto the books, because every white Southerner for 150 years at least went to church.
Yeah.
And was a member of a church, whether you're Church of God, whether you're Baptist, didn't matter.
Yeah. Well, as I had mentioned earlier, Christ's sheep go where they are fed, and these churches are absolutely useless about passing out the right food for the sheep. And a lot of people just quit going, so now they have no moral foundation. You know, they don't even know that usury is stealing, for example. Okay.
Today Today the churches accept these sins, and not only do they accept them, they promote them. And it's just incredible to me that the average Southerner, say our age, who should know of this shift because it happened in their lifetimes, they ignore it and they don't think about the consequences and the implications. Was your church wrong 50 years ago? And if it was wrong 50 years ago, why are you there today? Because it's right today? Was your grandfather evil for living in a state that banned sodomy or banned interracial marriage? Does that make your ancestors evil? So every Southerner had evil ancestors. They don't even think about those implications. I'm sorry.
Right. No, it's quite all right. You know, the average person today, how do they, I don't even understand how they can think that our churches didn't teach these things and it wasn't evil, it wasn't wrong. I mean, you got so many people today, even people that ought to know better in this various Southern movements, that are always apologizing for slavery. Slavery as an institution, just like marriage, is ordained by and regulated by Yahweh. And slavery is not a sin if it is practiced in the way that Yahweh has ordained it to be practiced.
Right.
And everybody thinks of slavery as, you know, black chattel slavery alone. But under Yahweh's guidance, I'm not telling you anything you don't know, obviously. But, you know, slavery is beneficial to our society. It replaces the prison system, which is a big drain on our system, and doesn't produce anything of value. You know, if somebody commits a crime, there's only two punishments under Yahweh's law. That's death or restitution, and there's no prison. So you basically are enslaved to the person. It's like indentured servitude, for example. I mean, we had indentured servitude for quite a long time in early America, and it worked out good for us, you know. And people just don't know the benefits of Yahweh's law because they've been told the law has been done away with. Yahweh's law is perfect. It's liberty. Yahweh's law is liberty. And we don't have liberty because we don't follow his law.
Absolutely. I fully agree. It's...
I knew you would. I wasn't telling you anything you didn't know.
Well, it's good that people hear it from you. It's... They hear it from me every week, my listener, right? I mean, it's... This leads me to I guess I don't want to take your entire day, but to what I thought would be one of the objectives of this conversation is going forward. It's been very difficult for the League of the South to go forward after Charlottesville, in my opinion. What we are seen as pariahs now by common folk for standing up for what is good and what is right. And we, that idea that everybody that opposes these leftist values is immoral, and we're seen that way, I believe, by the general public today, that we're the immoral ones.
Yeah. Well, ever since Charlottesville and the very next rally after that at Shelbyville, we pledged ourselves that there would never be another Charlottesville and there would never be another Shelbyville. We all know what happened at Charlottesville, but the problem we encountered at Shelbyville was the police were so determined not to have another Charlottesville on their hands that they went to extreme measures in corralling our side. I didn't see them doing this to the communists.
No,
but you remember how they ran us through a cattle chute and inspected each one of us, shook us all down, anything that could even remotely be considered a weapon. Somebody had an Iron Cross medal taken from them and thrown into a 55-gallon drum. You couldn't enter the protest area unless you went through this cattle chute and surrendered anything at all that they thought might be bad for, you know, security. And then they hustled us into this tiny little corral on the opposite side of the street from the protesters. We were crammed in like sardines. Literally, there was barely any room to move amongst ourselves. It was a terrible situation. And from that day forward, we decided two things. Number one, we were not going to have any more announced demonstrations. The announcements, all they do is they alert Antifa and other communists about where and when you're going to be, and they're going to marshal their forces there, and the entire demonstration will be about them instead of our message. So we decided that we weren't going to even contact the police either for most occasions. We're going to shift our tactics to like what would be commonly referred to as a flash mob. We would arrive unannounced. We would video our message to the public. We would do whatever else was necessary. Whether it's erecting a flag, placing a wreath, or whatever the case may be. We'd film all this, and then we would leave. And, rather than have maybe a couple few hundred angry Antifa members being witnesses to our demonstration, the entire American public could be a witness to our demonstration through video. And we started doing that, and that worked out a whole lot better. But, a lot of people, even in the league, they don't understand that the league must evolve to keep up with current times, current situations, current tactics of the enemy and the government, which is one and the same. And I try to point to them the actions of one of the most effective resistance movements to ever have sprung up on North American soil. And that is the original Ku Klux Klan that was led by Confederate veterans and mostly peopled by Confederate veterans. You know, in the early days of the Klan, they would put on these grand demonstrations. You know, they would be robed, their horses would be robed, and they would march down the center of streets of downtown areas, and they would get a lot of attention. They would frighten the right people. People realize that, hey, the Klan is very powerful. We better mind our P's and Q's here. And this worked for a while, but it worked too effectively for the enemy. And political leadership, like Governor Brownlow of Tennessee, for example, he set out to eliminate the Klan. And a woman who sewed Klan robes could be fined $500 in the 1860s. If, you know, that's like, you know, $1 million judgment today. And if you were found to be a member of the Klan, you would be imprisoned if you were lucky, or killed on the spot if you weren't so lucky. So the tactics of the Klan had to change. There was no more public demonstrations marching down Main Street. They literally became the invisible empire. It got to the point where no one knew who was in the Klan. They didn't see the Klan. They only felt the Klan. When the Klan had something to do, they didn't talk about it. They didn't demonstrate. They didn't put on a big show about it. They went and they took care of business, and then the business was over with, and nobody talked about it. That was the proper evolution for the Klan at that time, based on enemy actions. And the League is going to have to continue to evolve just as it has evolved since 1992. Things are much different today in the League than they were when the League was first formed. Things will be much different in the League 5 years from now, 10 years from now. And we must continue to evolve, or we will become absolutely useless. And there's things going on in the League that the average person doesn't know about. And that's just the way that it has to be, because we are up against an incredible force. The government has garnered more powers in the last 20 years. And things just aren't the same as they were in 1992. So our people have to realize that just because they don't see something going on, it doesn't mean that things are not going on. The League is still just as active as they were before. Charlottesville, Shelbyville, et cetera. We're just active in different ways right now.
Yes, sir. And I'm sure, you know, the League, everything, I don't need to know what's going on in Virginia, Georgia, Alabama, and I don't, and that's fine. I'm fine with that. I only know what's going on in my local chapter, and in the Florida State chapter. When we get together, you might hear things about so and so's doing this or that. That's fine, but no, I don't need to know anything. That's right. One of the beautiful aspects of the organization, the League of the South, is that. What do I need to know it for? It goes back to what I said about only being able to control, and you can't even control that, right? What, only being able to help or assist what I could see and feel and touch. And to me, that's just my local chapter.
Right. Yeah. A lot of people don't understand the concept of a need to know. They want to know too much. You know, we're information junkies. We want to know everything. Things that's going on with everybody everywhere. We've been kind of spoiled by national news networks. I mean, who really cares if a busload of Pakistanis went over a cliff yesterday? Okay. That has nothing to do with me. It doesn't affect me, but that's the kind of stuff we hear on national news. But that's the talk around the water cooler the next day. Hey,
right.
Did you hear about that bus in Pakistan?
Brightens my day. You know, I post things like that sometimes because it brightens my day.
It's entertainment. It's entertainment. Yes. It's not news.
It is entertainment.
If they would just admit.
I agree.
Yeah, if they just admit that it's entertainment, we could have entertainment networks instead of being called a news network. But the only thing that's important is what's going on around us in our own city, county, state, and region. And that's where the league needs to focus. At the lowest level, in your own communities, building an organic organization of servant leaders in your own community. And that includes getting involved in the political process as well.
That servant leader. And I agree with getting involved in the political process on a local level. And that's fine.
Absolutely.
That should probably be a different conversation for a different day. But unless you really want to have it now, I mean, that's fine too. That's up to you. But the servant leader role is that's the league's philosophy, that we should all be servant leaders. Yet you don't join the League of the South saying, what's the League of the South going to do for me? You join the League of the South so that you could take initiative and do something for your people.
Absolutely.
That is also, I'm sorry, that is also a
thing.
That's the fabric of Christianity.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah, the servant leader thing, it definitely ties in with local politics. We encourage all of our members to run for office. If you can't run for office for some reason, then you need to support your local politics. Obviously, we don't care about the federal government. If we care anything about who's sitting in the Oval Office, we care because we want whatever works for the empire. I'm completely happy that Joe Biden is running America into the ground. That's fine. It just helps accelerate the balkanization of the South from the rest of the country. But at the city, county, and state level, we definitely need to become actively involved in politics. It matters who is leading Florida right now. We've had some arguments recently, even with league members, about supporting Governor DeSantis in the Republican Party. You know, we don't support the Republican Party. We support whoever is going to be the best leader for Florida, regardless of what political party they're affiliated with. And it just so happens that right now, Governor DeSantis is the best bet for us. But you can't become a servant leader of your community without involving yourself in the system, that we created to allow people to serve their community. So,
and I really think that the average member needs a better understanding of that. I don't know that I could promote a Ron DeSantis to the outside world, but I would promote secession to Republicans, if you know what I mean. And if I favor DeSantis over a Charlie Crist, it's only because DeSantis is better for Florida. And anybody should see that. We're going to have some corporate or enemy-supported candidate or another in office, and whether we like it or not. So we may as well have one that's more preferable to states' rights and isolationism than one that is completely in bed with Nancy Pelosi and Joe Biden. So which is it? Toss it.
Absolutely.
That should be a no-brainer. I wouldn't put a Ron DeSantis sign on my front lawn. I don't want to look like a Republican. But it's basically a no-brainer that we would rather preserve what little liberty that we have left. Because if Charlie Crist is governor in January, we're all going to be under lockdown, wearing face masks in our own homes. So, which is crazy, right? I might be exaggerating, but that's the way the Yankee mentality is.
I don't think you're exaggerating. Yeah, I don't think you're exaggerating. You pretty much said that we're going to have lockdowns and mask wearing.
Yeah.
That's pretty much the position of the League of the South. Voting in a state level.
Right. And when you see people driving down the highway wearing a face mask while they're locked in their own vehicle with all the windows up, that's the mentality of these people that vote for Charlie Crist or it's insane. They're insane. The television has made them insane.
Yeah, that face mask. that face mask is a clear indicator of a person's political beliefs and conscience. It's easy to see.
Well, I thank you very much for the conversation, and I pray we may have more in the future.
I hope we do, sir. I'm sorry it took so long to get to this one.
That's fine. It's all in Yahweh's good timing. But I hope to show at our Southern kindred, at least, but I'm sure that, or I pray that a lot of people outside of the South that listen to Christogenia also understand and get something out of this podcast. I'd like to show our Southern kindred that the League of the South, if you really want to walk the Christian walk, it's an opportunity to do that. And it's probably a better opportunity than most others' organization. It's certainly better than all the churches. That's a no-brainer.
Yeah.
The whole concept, yeah. And I even,
well, it
I'm sorry.
Okay. No,
I even get sort of disappointed that league members go to church if they go to church, because they don't, that they know those churches are just arms of the beast, that they're symptoms of the great whore who's joined herself to mystery. I mean, I don't know why they're there. The league, your local community of kindred, like-minded brethren in Christ, that's your church.
I think they're just wed to the traditions of men. Their parents went to that church, or grandparents went to that church, and even though the church is decayed and is no longer teaching the truth, it's just a tradition to go to that church.
Right. I agree.
I can't say anything else for it. It took me, I did a lot of looking around before I found the league. And I looked at a lot of churches, I looked at a lot of other organizations, and the League was the one organization to put everything together in place for me. It satisfied the spiritual need, it satisfied my political needs, my racial needs, everything. It just cannot compete with one of the current so-called churches. So, yeah, the League is my church.
Well, where your treasure is, that's where your heart is, or should be. Thank you again, sir. It's been a pleasure and an honor.
Well, thank you for having me, sir. It was also a pleasure.
Praise Yahweh, the God of Israel, and good night. Even though it's 10:44 a.m., I'm saying good night because this is a Friday night thing. Okay, thank you. God bless.
Yeah, good night, sir.